Jazakallah for your concern, and we appreciate it very much. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Jazallahu anna Muhammadin sallallahu alayhi wa sallam bima wa ahluhu. Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ali Sayyidina Muhammadin wa barik wa sallim. Rabbi shrali sadri wa yassirli amri wa lulukta min lisani yafqahu qawli. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Maulana, we continue with our history of the Mughal Empire. With last week we dealt with Babur, but before we go to that, I've seen a very interesting article penned by an associate professor at Al-Aqsa University in Gaza, and this is Professor Haider Eid, and he has written an article that genocide Israel is living in the past. This is on the opinion section in Al Jazeera. And it's not very long, so therefore I'm going to take advantage of reading it. Alhamdulillah, I think it gives us a good perspective, notwithstanding what is taking place in Gaza and in Palestine, you know, with the genocide that is being carried out by the Zionist entity. The old world is dying and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. This is a saying by Italian philosopher Antonio Gramsci, who wrote in 1929. The professor says, these words come to mind as I observe apartheid Israel disintegrating rapidly in the historic sense of the word. It is a settler colony that is failing its mission, namely annihilating the native population and replacing them with the civilized settlers. As the apartheid regime slowly implodes, the Palestinians, especially the Palestinians of Gaza, are paying a horrific price, with more than 50,000 people being killed, especially women, children, and men. The Jewish state, as it defines itself, has committed unimaginable war crimes and has violated countless international laws. And it has managed to get away with all these crimes thanks to unlimited support provided by the colonial West, especially the United States of America and Europe. Nonetheless, the collapse is proceeding at a steady pace. Many have failed to understand that this disintegration is inevitable, including, paradoxically, the leadership of the Palestinian people. It is for this lack of foresight that Palestinian leaders signed onto the Oslo Accords and made the racist two-state solution a national campaign camouflaged as independence. Oslo effectively erased the settler colonial nature of Palestinian oppression and instead presented it as an ancient war over the ownership of land. By signing the accords, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat completely disregarded the reality of settler colonialism the Palestinians were suffering in. Immediately after the handshake between Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin in 1993, Palestinian scholar Edward Said wrote, "Now that the," and this we quote, "now that the euphoria has faded a little, we can take a closer look at the agreement between Israel and the PLO with the necessary cool head. It turns out that it is way more inadequate and unbalanced for most Palestinians than many initially assumed. The vulgar staging of the ceremony at the White House, the humiliating performance of Arafat as he thanked the world for giving up most of the rights of the Palestinian people, and the laughable role of Bill Clinton as a 20th century Roman emperor, accompanying his two vassal kings in the rituals of reconciliation and submission. All this could only temporarily obscure the truly unbelievable extent of the Palestinian surrender." Sometimes, Professor says, he wonders whether Arafat and the rest of the leadership of the PLO had read, say, Franz Fanon, Amelia Cabral, Hassan Kafanafani, or any of the anti-colonial figures of their time. Political Zionism, claiming to represent the Jewish nation, emerged in the 19th century Europe, and it naturally emulated the European ideologies of the time. It claimed the right to establish its own state in any territory in the world, no matter where. It set its eyes on Palestine, claimed that it was a land without a people for a people without a land, and did what Europeans had already done in Africa, the Americas, Australia, New Zealand, and parts of Asia. Genocide, as so many anti-colonial works have documented, is and always has been an intrinsic component of settler colonialism. They are inseparable, and this is the case of settler colonial Zionism. One cannot understand the ongoing live stream slaughter of 2 million people of Gaza and the bragging about it by the majority of Israelis on social media without relating it to that colonial hegemonic ideology. Since its creation, Israel has systematically pursued the elimination of the native. Gaza right now is paying the price for what Israel's leading fascist historian Benny Morris has argued is the Israel's failure to transfer all Palestinians out of Palestine in 1948. That is because in 1948, Gaza became the largest refugee camp in the world, filled with native Palestinians who refused to be ethnically cleansed and genocided, and who have constantly reminded the Israelis of the unfinished job. They are now bearing the wrath of genocidal Israel, intending on establishing its claim as a fact that there is no such thing as Palestinian people. But the prosperity of apartheid and settler colonialism is part of history now. A state founded on them cannot survive. Amid the genocide in Gaza, this may not be as obvious, but let us remember that the downfall of South Africa's apartheid regime began in the darkest moments of South African history in the late 1980s. When everything looked so bleak. At that time, people did not realize that the racist regime was disintegrating and a new dawn was approaching. Resistance in its various forms, mixed with the highest level of Samud, that is steadfastness, has become the norm in Gaza. The resistance in Samud are expected to spread throughout historic Palestine and other places. This includes Syria, the whole of Sham. Gaza has become the center of the universe. If it falls, the global south will follow suit. The world has no option but to dismantle the only remaining apartheid regime, committing an unprecedented genocide in the 21st century. Sometimes the professor writes, he dreams of having the ability to visit the future and come back with a message. In the future, I drive my car on the coastal road from Gaza in the south to Haifa in the north, listening to Fairuz's angelic voice and telling my daughters about the horrific past when a state called Israel forbade us from seeing the rest of our country. I tell them about the time when the world stood idle while Israel butchered tens of thousands of children and women, and when ultimately people of conscience decided that enough is enough. As American writer Mike Davis so eloquently put it, what keeps us going ultimately is our love for each other and our refusal to bow our heads to accept the verdict, however all-powerful it seems. I come back from the future full of optimism that the time of monsters will be over soon. This is the end of the article, Molana. It's a very wonderful article, dear listeners. And I think this is, as we said last week also, the countdown has begun for these dictators in the West to come to their senses that it's not democracy disguised it's not freedom disguised as democracy that rules the world. It is going to be the recognition of the humanity of people to seek their and pursue their interests for their own betterment. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We continue with our history on Pakistan, and we are busy with the Mughal Empire. Last week we dealt with the ascension and the rise of Babur, the founder of the Mughal Empire. At the death of Babur, the battles that Babur fought in India had a considerable strain on his death. He died at Agra on the 26th December 1530, at the young age of 47. His rule in India lasted for less than 4 years. During this period, he had to fight three main battles. True to his name, Babur was a tiger among men, full of indomitable energy and prowess. He led an extraordinary life, full of adventures, bitter defeats and frustrations, as well as brilliant victories and astounding achievements. He was a man of attractive personality with well-developed, refined taste, with a broad outlook. He was not only a skillful general and a capable administrator. He was a poet, a scholar, an artist, and a naturalist as well. He wrote his autobiography, Tuzuke Babri, which ranks high among great autobiographies. According to his will, his dead body was carried to Kabul for burial. Babur was succeeded by his son Nasiruddin Humayun. Humayun was a man of peace, but peace was denied to him. His name meant one favored by fortune, but fortune eluded him. He was a man of many qualities, but he could not adjust himself to the things around him. Magnanimous and kind by nature, he forgave when he should have punished. Light-hearted and sociable, he reveled in the company of friends when he should have been in the field. The troubles of Humayun began at the outset of his reign due to the unbrotherly conduct of his brothers. In his will, Babur had instructed Humayun to be kind to his brothers. True to the will of his father, Humayun treated his brothers kindly, but they took undue advantage of his kindness. Kamran was the independent ruler of Kabul. After the death of Babur, Kamran invaded the Punjab and occupied it. Because of his kindness to his brother, Humayun acquiesced in the occupation of Punjab by Kamran. The loss of Punjab weakened the defenses of the Mughal rule in India, and most of the later troubles of Humayun were due to the treacherous occupation of Punjab by Kamran. Although the Afghans had been defeated at the battles of Panipat and Gogra, they were not completely subdued and they burned with the desire to take revenge from the Mughals and drive them from the soil of India. After the death of Babur, the Afghans under Mahmud Lodi made another bid to overthrow the Mughals. Mahmud Lodi led a revolt in the east and captured Jaunpur. Humayun marched at the head of a force in Jaunpur. In the confrontation that took place at Dadra in 1532, the Afghans were defeated and with a heavy loss, and Jaunpur was recaptured by the Mughals. The Afghans next rallied under Sher Khan and took a stand at Chunar further east. Humayun advanced to Chunar. The Battle of Chunar was not decisive, and a hasty peace was negotiated with the Afghans, which ultimately worked to the disadvantage of the Mughals. While Humayun was still engaged in the campaign against the Afghans, Bahadur Shah, the ruler of Gujarat in the southwest, raised the standard of revolt. He was involved in a conspiracy to depose Humayun. and sent one of the cousins of Humayun to the throne. Humayun left the campaign in the east unfinished and rushed to Gujarat at the other end. In 1534, Humayun attacked Malwa, eastern part of the state of Gujarat. In the confrontation that took place, Bahadur Shah suffered a reverse and retreated to Gujarat. Humayun hotly pursued Bahadur Shah into Gujarat. Bahadur Shah shut himself in the strong fortress of Champaner. Humayun captured the fortress by assault in August 1535. Bahadur Shah took shelter with the Portuguese in the island of Diu, and Gujarat was annexed to the Mughal Empire. While Humayun was in Gujarat, the Afghans availed of this opportunity to gather strength. The Afghans under Sher Khan captured Bengal and thereby gained considerably in power. Sher Khan now became a great threat to the Mughal rule. Humayun rushed to the Gujarat, from Gujarat to Bengal, and in the campaign that followed, Humayun succeeded in capturing Gaur, the capital of Bengal. When the monsoons burst, further campaigns had to be suspended. Thereafter, an epidemic spread in the Mughal army, and Humayun decided to return to Agra. That proved to be a fatal mistake. Sher Khan blocked the communications and created difficulties for the Mughal army on the return march. The two forces met in action at the battlefield of Chosa in 1539. The Mughal army was demoralized and suffered heavy defeat. The Mughal treasure fell into the hands of Sher Khan. Humayun saved himself with difficulty by crossing the river with the aid of a water carrier. After the Battle of Chosa, Sher Khan decided himself to be the emperor and assumed the title of Sher Shah. Humayun made another attempt to measure swords with the Afghans. In 1540, there was another confrontation between the Mughals and the Afghans at Kannauj. Fortune no longer favored the Mughals, and they were decisively defeated. As a consequence, the empire passed from the Mughals to the Afghans. Humayun was betrayed by his brothers and he fled the country. He wandered as a fugitive in the deserts of Sindh for 3 years. It was during this period that he married Hamida Banu, and Akbar was born to him at Umar Court in October 4, 1541. Thereafter, Humayun proceeded to Persia and sought refuge with the Safavid Shah, Shah Tahmasp. After the flight of Humayun, Sher Shah became the undisputed master of northern India. His dominions comprised Bengal, Bihar, Jaunpur, Delhi, and Agra. After the overthrow of the Mughals, Sher Shah embarked on a career of further conquest. He conquered the Punjab first, which was held by Kamran, a brother of Humayun. After the conquest of the Punjab, he built a strong fort at Rohtas in the Jhelum district to serve as a military base for further military operations. Proceeding westward, he overpowered the Khakas who had supported Humayun. While Sher Shah was undertaking military operations in the west, Khizr Khan, the governor of Bengal, revolted in the east. Sher Shah marched at the head of a large force to Bengal and suppressed the revolt. Thereafter, Sher Shah turned to Sindh and annexed it to his dominions. Then he marched to central India and annexed Malwa. In 1545, campaigns were undertaken in Rajputana. In a bloody action, Sher Shah defeated Raja Puran Mal of Resina and occupied the fort of Resina. The next campaign was undertaken against Jodhpur. After the defeat of Raja Maldev of Jodhpur, the entire region of Ajmer to Mount Abu came under the control of Sher Shah. After these conquests, Sher Shah marched to Bundelkhund and laid siege to the fort of Kalinga. Sher Shah captured the fort, but he died from an accidental explosion of gunpowder on the 22nd May 1545. Sher Shah was a great general, a seasoned statesman, a far-sighted administrator, a capable ruler, and a successful organizer. He appeared on the horizon of India as a comet and was likewise quick to disappear. He rose from obscurity to power because of his rare qualities of leadership. As a ruler, he introduced far-reaching reforms conceived in a progressive spirit. He constructed the Great Trunk Road, which ran from Sanur Gaon in the east to Attock in the west. He set up a network of caravanserais throughout the length and breadth of the country. He built a strong line of fortifications along the frontiers of the empire. He reorganized the administration and vitalized the institutions for the collection of land revenue and the administration of justice. He abolished the vexatious tolls and inland duties. He improved the system of intelligence and espionage. Under him, the country enjoyed a spell of prosperity. He was an extraordinary genius and endowed with exceptional talents. After the death of Sher Shah, there was a war of succession between his two sons, Adil Khan and Jalal Khan, in a hotly contested battle fought near Agra in October 1545. The elder brother, Adil Khan, was defeated and the younger brother, Jalal Khan, captured power. On accession, Jalal Khan assumed the throne in the name of Islam Shah. Islam Shah undertook campaigns against the Ghakas and suppressed them. Islam Shah was intelligent and brave, but he failed to keep the Afghans united. He developed differences with the Niyazis and tried to suppress them with force. That proved to be a fatal move, which led to the disintegration of the state founded by Sher Shah. Islam Shah did not live long and died in 1554. His rule lasted for a period of 9 years only. Islam Shah was then succeeded by his son Firuz. There were intrigues and conspiracies here at the Afghan court. Firuz was assassinated by his maternal uncle, Muhammad Adil, who ascended the throne assuming the name of Adil Shah. Adil Shah proved to be a worthless ruler, and all power came to be concentrated in the hands of his Hindu minister, Emu, who dreamt of establishing the Hindu Raj. Soon revolts broke out in various parts of the country. One of the Sur princesses, Ibrahim, declared that Adil Shah was a usurper and led a revolt against him. The rebel prince seized Agra and Delhi. Thereupon, Adil Shah retired to Chunar. Another Sur prince, Sikandar Shah, led a revolt against Ibrahim and drove him from the cities of Agra and Delhi. As a result of these dissensions among the Afghans, the process of disintegration of the Afghan state came to get a pace. That provided the opportunity to Humayun in exile to stage a comeback. With the help of the Shah of Persia, Humayun captured Kabul. Then in the occupation of his brother, Kamran, after consolidating his position at Kabul, Humayun descended on India. The march of the Mughals through the Punjab was a walkover, and the Afghans could offer no resistance. There was a confrontation between the Mughals and the Afghans at Sarhind, known as the Gate to India. The Afghans were no longer a virile force as before. They gave a poor show at the battle and were defeated with a heavy loss. This was the end of the rule of the Sur dynasty, Chefs are an extraordinary genius, built a strong empire, but his successors could not maintain it, and his empire crumbled within 10 years of his death. It was one of the shortest-lived dynasties in history. If Sher Shah had not met the accident in Kalanjahan, Humayun could not have staged a comeback. Verily, strange are the ways of history, and accidents often turn the course of history. After an exile of 15 years, and this is very interesting, Maulana and the listeners, Humayun succeeded in recapturing the throne of India in 1555. He did not live to enjoy the fruits of his victory. Within a year of his restoration to power, Humayun slipped while descending from the upper story of his observatory and died because of the fall. Humayun is an extraordinary figure of medieval history. Ordinarily, when political power is once lost, it is lost forever. Humayun is one of the few kings in history who succeeded in recovering the throne after a lapse of 15 years. Humayun was more of a scholar than a soldier, and if peace had been allowed to him, he would have been able to make a great contribution in the cultural field than he was able to do. Because of the turbulence of the period of his rule, in some mysterious way, misfortune overshadowed his path, and when after years of eclipse, he was able to recapture power, he was not able to rule for more than a year. He had to encounter many falls during his lifetime, and his death was also because of a fall. That had made Stanley Poole remark that Humayun tumbled through life, and he tumbled out of it also. Humayun was only 49 years old at the time of his death. Humayun was succeeded by his son Jalaluddin Akbar, who was hardly 13 years old at the time. It may be recalled that his grandfather Babur was 11 years old when he succeeded his father to the principality of Fergana. At the time of the death of Humayun, Akbar was operating in the Punjab against the Afghans. When the news of the death of Humayun was received in the Punjab, Akbar was hastily crowned at Kalanjahan in the district of Gurdaspur. Bahram Khan, the trusted general of Humayun, took over as the regent and guardian of the young prince. Ji Maulana, we have now come to the end of our getting, and we continue with the rise of Akbar to power and his rule in India, creating a lot of division and trying to interfere with the religion of Islam. To the listeners and to yourself, Maulana, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.